Over the past year and a half or so, we've interviewed a guy named Sherman Austin a couple of times. He's a young black anarchist organizer, lives in Long Beach, California, and we've been following his story through the FBI raid on his home in February 2002, through his arrest at the World Economic Forum shortly after that, and more recently, we've talked to him about his recent legal quagmire. Now, a couple weeks ago, we told you that on August 4th, Sherman Austin was sentenced to a year in federal prison and 3 years of probation after that, with some rather appalling conditions attached to it. This is going to be starting for him on September 3rd. We've got Sherman Austin again joining us on the phone right now, I hope. Can you hear me?
Yeah, what's up?
Okay, great. Look, we were shocked and appalled when we talked to you before. I was reasonably hopeful that you were going to see an end to this that you would be happy with. I know they have charged you in the past and dropped the charges.
Yeah.
I know you're obviously disappointed with how this turned out, but are you as surprised as we are? I mean, having lived through what you've had to live through, and I know you've been through some challenging legal trouble, I guess.
Yeah.
So are you surprised at how it turned out? Were you realistically hopeful? I remember that when we first talked, and I asked you in one of the other interviews anyway, whether you were happy with your legal representation, for example, and you told me at the time you were. Do you still feel the same way?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. I mean, most of all, I mean, at first, like, when this all happened, like, I wanted to go to trial because, you know, the first time I decided to, you know, present me with a plea bargain, that plea bargain was 1 month in jail and 5 months community confinement. And then, like, if I was going to go to trial, all I was facing was, like, 3 or 4 years maximum in a prison if I were to get convicted. But then, like, you know, after a while of kind of not accepting the plea and, like, going back and forth and the prosecutors keeping the plea on the table, we pretty much found out that the terrorism enhancement, which can add additional, you know, potential 20 years added onto my sentence could apply, was actually applicable to what I was being charged with. So basically, if I were to go to trial, then I would be, you know, risking about 23, 24, you know, years in federal prison. So then that's pretty much what stopped me from wanting to go to trial and then basically wanted to, you know, agree with the plea agreement.
Well, yeah, we understood from the last time we talked to you was not all that many months ago, I don't think. And
yeah.
You explained how you were feeling about the situation with the plea at that time. But what happened was the judge, in the end, refused to accept the plea. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, even the first time he went to court, in which the plea was 1 month in jail and 5 months in a community confinement, you know, like a halfway house.
Okay.
And that was the minimum sentencing range, because the sentencing range under the plea was between 6 and 12 months, and what they were going to give me was the low end, which is just a 6 months in custody. And when that what that was just 1 month in jail plus the 5 months in community confinement. And the judge rejected that, saying he wanted to get me at least a year in prison. And that was, like, one of the first hearings we had to try and get the judge to accept the plea. And, like, he just kind of, like, went off and said, like 1 month in jail wasn't, like, nearly as much as I should be getting and things like that.
Is this the same judge that sentenced you in the end?
Yeah.
So it's fair to say that he made up his mind what your sentence was going to be a long, long time before he delivered his sentence.
Yeah, I mean, he made up his mind, like, the first time I stepped in there. I mean, that's why I wasn't really surprised at his decision on the last sentencing when I got sentenced, because, I mean, that's what he said the first time I went in there. He wanted to give me at least a year. And then, you know, when I went back another time, like, he said he wanted to make an example for future revolutionaries. I mean, that's, like, directly his own quote right there. So, I mean, like, it's obvious that this was nothing but a political case, especially to him, and that he just wanted to make an example.
Does he not realize that his country was founded by revolutionaries?
Yeah.
I mean, how... It's difficult to understand, but in a way, he's part of the government and he's part of the power elite, if you will, and he has a stake in the kind of control that he's exerting over you.
Yeah.
And so you're being your position is that not no you must feel you're being used as an example, and he's told you that you're this is why you're before the courts.
Yeah.
So the other question I have is I'm a little unsure about what the actual charge is. So it's something to do with distributing material relating to explosives or Molotov cocktails or something along that line.
Yeah, the actual charge is distribution of information related to explosives with intent. Like, apparently, distributing information related to explosives over the internet isn't illegal, but what is illegal is intent. And that's like the kind of iffy part there, because I mean, how do you prove intent? It's almost like thought crime, because like you can say someone has intent just because, you know, they're an anarchist or they just don't agree with, you know, the current political system in this country right now. And someone who's like a white supremacist neo-Nazi who has something called the White Resistance Manual on his website that goes over everything from firearms to explosives to assassinations to threats isn't a threat, because maybe he has enough money to hire a really good private attorney and fight the system, unlike a lot of other people out there who just aren't in that same privilege, who they can't, you know, hire, you know, spend thousands and thousands of dollars on, you know, big-time lawyers who can go out and fight this thing for them. So, I mean, like, it's like thought crime when they say intent. I think it's almost like it's better for them with the intent part, because then they can use it as a form of selective enforcement on people they want to get convicted and people that just don't really care about.
From what I've been reading, it's basically the as far as the actual material on your website goes, it's just one link that is okay. That's the offending material, and it's
exactly
it's a link to material that you didn't write.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the funny thing is, like, the charge is distribution of information related to explosives, but I wasn't distributing information on explosives. I just had a link on my site which linked to another website which had about 10 pages, and about, you know, one of those 10 pages had information on explosives on it. The rest of the site dealt with things like security culture and things like protests and things like that.
So you didn't even, it wasn't a direct link to the page with the offensive information on it?
No, it was just like a link to that website, and that website had like various other pages on it, and on one of those pages had explosives information on it.
And what, pray tell, was the fate of the person who wrote the offensive material?
Nothing happened to him. Even the FBI knew that he authored it. Even when they came to my house, because at the first time when they came to my house, I mean, they asked me like at least like 5 or 7 times if I had authored the web pages that dealt with explosives and things like that. And I told them like directly no, like every time they asked me. And then when they arrested me in the arrest affidavit, they wrote down that I said that I admitted to authoring the information on explosives and that I implemented those web pages. And then, like, a few months later, they actually interviewed the kid who actually, you know, created that entire site and authored all the information on explosives and implemented all those web pages. But still, like, even when we were going back and forth getting the plea agreements changed because the judge was, you know, was always rejecting things and we always had to, like, get things taken out, get things changed, like, every time the prosecutors would come back with a new plea agreement, and even in the pre-sentencing report, in which the USPO had to consult with the FBI on in order to write it up completely, they put back in stating that I admitted that I had authored the information on explosives, and when they clearly know that I didn't.
This makes it even more baffling that under these circumstances you wouldn't have had a legal representation that would have been able to prove that they knew that. Do you know what I mean? Certainly the police must have had to submit records or...
Yeah.
Like, you, I mean... You're saying they knew you didn't write it, but they were continuously lying in court. There should have been... Was that challenged at any point in court? Did your lawyer stand up and say, that guy's lying?
I don't know, because it was kind of iffy, because a lot of the things in court, like a lot of things were said, like the terminology was always mixed up. Like, there's a big difference between posting a link and then distributing information or authoring information. And that's one of the things I don't think was really emphasized enough in court, especially when we went before the judge at my sentencing. Because, I mean, the judge said himself, like, he was basically sitting there accusing me of teaching people how to make explosives over the internet, but I wasn't teaching anyone how to make explosives. I simply had a link on my site, which linked to a different site, which somebody else authored, which taught people how to make explosives. Like, I myself don't know anything about explosives.
But it's not the actual distributing the information that's the violation of the law here. It's your alleged intent.
Yeah, just alleged intent, I guess. All you have to do is just post a link somewhere, and then if they want to say you have intent, they can go after you for it.
I became aware of a couple things since the first time I interviewed you, and one of them, which is going to be perhaps the easiest one to deal with, was the fact that you were one of the many people who were arrested at a May Day demonstration in Long Beach in, I guess it was May 1st, 2001, maybe 2000, 2000 or 2000?
2001.
But I remember reporting that here at the time. Because that was, you know, that was big news back then when you'd go to a demonstration and they would just beat and arrest everyone. That's, yeah. I guess, become more normal behavior since then. But at the time, that was really surprising, and I was not aware the last two times that I talked with you that you were actually among the people who were arrested at that.
Yeah.
And that there has been a certain amount of harassment at the hands of law enforcement of other people who were arrested during that demonstration.
Yeah.
And basically, I heard you talking on another interview about people who weren't anarchists, even necessarily getting accused of being associated with an info shop or something that you had opened up in Long Beach.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
do you want to talk about that? And do you really think that that has anything to do with why they went after you after that time?
Yeah, sure. I mean, after the raid, when I got back, because after the raid, I had still continued my plans to go to New York to protest the World Economic Forum, and I was arrested there by the FBI. And, like, after 13 days, I was released, and then I came back to Los Angeles, and then once I came back to L.A., I moved out to Long Beach, and I lived at the info shop down there, which was called the Reach Center. And I just basically continued my political work within the community. And a lot of things were going on. I mean, police would just stop people, like random people on the streets, just because they looked a certain way or they were wearing a certain color, and automatically accused them of being anarchists. And, like, a lot of people would just come into the center, our info shop, and would, you know, be complaining about how police would follow them to their apartments, stop them and search them, question them if they were affiliated in any way with the info shop, if they had ever been to the info shop, and things like that.
And you were saying...
One guy came in there crying because police had thrown him to the ground and put guns to his head and questioned him about the place and asking him if he was affiliated with us at all. I mean, it was pretty interesting, too, because I noticed a lot of people started coming in around the same time. Like, there was a big wave of harassment going on because people didn't come in, like, one here, then, like, 5 months down the line, like another person here, like we noticed people coming in telling us what was happening to them, like within a certain period of time, like it was just continuous harassment that was going on against just normal people, you know, walking down the street that police just happened to accuse of being anarchists or being affiliated with the place, and then just, you know, searching them, following them to their apartments, parking outside of their apartments and things like that. I mean, it's just blatant harassment, blatant repression.
And for the crime of, like, wearing too much red or black or whatever.
Exactly. And, I mean, this was the, you know, the intensity of the political repression that was going on following what happened on May Day in 2001. So, I mean, what happened there, from what I heard, it was, like, the worst case of police brutality in Long Beach in 33 years. I mean, they had, like, completely attacked us, like, out of nowhere. I mean, a lot of people got hurt. I myself had penetrating wounds into my calf. I still have a fragment of a rubber bullet still stuck in my calf. I've had it there for about 2 years now, ever since I got shot there. And, like, they had arrested about 114 of us. And, like, it was just like incredible. Like, I mean, it was bloody, and, like, I mean, I have never seen, like, that was the worst case of police brutality I've ever experienced. I mean, I had been shot before by police at other protests, such as police brutality protests, ironically, but, I mean, this was just, like, the worst case of police brutality I'd ever experienced.
So they literally, for people who might not remember that, they got, over 100 people were arrested in the end. They basically what was a peaceful protest had been going on for minutes, I gather, before the police charged in, separated the crowd, beat them with batons, shot them with rubber bullets, as you say, happened to yourself. I mean, the stories were pretty appalling. But to move on to the other thing that I was talking about earlier, the other thing I know now that I didn't know before, believe it or not, the first time we spoke, I was not aware that you were black. And the second time we spoke, although I was aware of it, I wasn't sure that that really was an appropriate thing to be talking about. You know, when you come from politically correct circles, you like to treat everybody equally, but the reality of living in the world is that that's not a realistic thing to think when you're talking about oppression. And it becomes rather obvious because of two specific points in your story, and one of them we've already touched on, and that was the fact that you're going to serve a year in jail and 3 years of probation. And the gentleman who wrote the offensive material that you, I mean, you didn't even link to the page that the offensive material was on. You made them, you know, for the crime of linking to his website. And the guy who wrote the offensive material, correct me if I'm wrong, is white, fairly affluent, and I read from Orange County, which I believe is one of the highest per capita incomes in your country.
Yeah.
Do you think race is part of the reason why you're going to jail and he's not?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. There's definitely racial implications in this. I mean, just in the entire, you know, so-called criminal justice system itself, I mean, there's so many racial implications. I mean, just standing there in court, I mean, seeing all the inmates who are brought in and chains and stuff like that, I mean, how often do you see, you know, a white person being brought in who comes from a, you know, middle-class background? I mean, I look at all the people who are inmates, and they're all people of color. I mean, the majority of people locked up in the prison industrial complex in America are people of color. Like, three-fourths of the prison population in this country are pretty much represented by, you know, blacks. And, I mean, this country has more people locked up in prisons than any other country in the world. And, I mean, that's really been the history of this country ever since day one. I mean, racial implications have always played a big part in the way this government goes after people and the way they persecute people and prosecute people and convict people. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, not surprisingly that there's definitely racial implications involved in my case as well.
And you were the victim. I know in another interview we talked about the police taking over your instant messengers. And what we didn't mention at that point was that some of the language that they used, I heard you talking about this in another interview last week, where you you had death threats, if I'm not mistaken, from people in law enforcement and people who said racist things to you.
Yeah.
And these were people in law enforcement, to the best of your knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, these were people in law enforcement, and I mean, they would just say a lot of, like, racist stuff, I mean, just straight out. And it was just like, I mean, at the same time, it kind of wasn't surprising because in law enforcement, there's so much racism going on. I mean, one time we were having a police brutality march here in Long Beach, and one of the cops, you know, standing there said, "I swear, I'm going to kill one of these black motherfuckers today." And some little girl heard that and told someone. I mean, that's just, you know, there's just so much racism in the police department and so much corruption, just not in Long Beach, but, you know, all over the world, not just here in America, but, I mean, everywhere.
How much time? I mean, I know in Canada, when you get sentenced to a year in prison, you don't necessarily serve it for a full year. Are you going to definitely be in there for a year?
I'm not sure exactly. From what I've heard, usually they let you out for a good time and things like that. I've heard other things, like in the federal system, they don't usually do that. If you're sentenced for a year, like, usually you have to be sentenced for over a year, like a year and one day, for you to get good time. My lawyer said that usually they don't let you out for good time if you're in there for a year or less. So I'm not really sure.
So you're probably going to be in there for a year.
Yeah, I mean, just for my own, like, mental health and things like that, like, I'm just going to assume I'm going to be in there for the whole full year. And pretty much, I'm not going to expect to get out for any good time.
And when you do get out, you're facing 3 years of probation under some of the most outrageous bail conditions.
Yeah.
That, in fact, I know for a fact, because bail conditions like this have been challenged and struck down in Canadian courts. Are these restrictions even constitutional? Are they constitutionally allowable in down where you live?
I don't even know anymore. Like, it's hard to tell what is constitutional and what isn't constitutional these days. I mean, especially with everything going on. And, you know, in the name to protect so-called national security, especially with the Patriot Act and the Patriot Act 2 coming along. Like, it's hard to tell what is even illegal or legal now these days. So, like, I mean, like, a lot of the things in there, like, one of the things is that I can't associate myself with anyone who's an anarchist or anyone who wants to change the government.
In any way?
Yeah.
Who wants to change the government in any way. That's what I found alarming. To me, that means you can't be a Democratic Party member if the Republicans are in power. Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. Like, it's absolutely, like, ridiculous. I mean, I don't know if they're going to really try and stick with it when I get out. Like, our plans are when I get out is to have a lot of these, like, ridiculous restrictions amended. I mean, it would surprise me if they're actually going to try and actually have that stick and actually pursue with that.
Well, it's an affront to your civil liberties. I mean, why aren't some of the more progressive legal organizations that regularly take that, you know, are known for taking on civil liberties cases? One of the things I was saying to one of my friends the other week is I can't believe the ACLU aren't all over this and that they're willing to go and fight for free speech for Nazis.
Yeah.
Have you had any contact with any possible future legal representation?
I'm not sure yet. Like, possibly, maybe in the future when I get out, maybe the ACLU can help. Because, I mean, they were contacted very early on in the case, and they basically said that they couldn't help on criminal cases, and there's nothing they could do.
Even though the crime is a link on your website, and you're being charged with something that, has anyone ever, to the best of your knowledge, are there other people in jail for having committed this offense?
To my knowledge, no. To my knowledge, I've been the first one who's been convicted under this new law. I think it passed in 1995, and so far I've been the first one, probably not the last, to be convicted under it.
No, well, this is a precedent-setting case, and if they get you in jail, as they seem to have, I mean,
yeah. There's
nothing to stop them from doing that to every other anarchist they happen to, you know, I mean, find a link on their website, too. I'm just thinking, like, how half the people I know would be in jail.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling. And for those people, since we didn't mention it so far during this interview here, Sherman is a webmaster of an anarchist website called RaiseTheFist.com. This is the website, I gather, that had the link on it that he's now charged with. From what I've been reading, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the website's going to continue on, isn't it?
Yeah. Definitely.
How is that going to work? A collective of some sort, or?
Yeah, basically a new collective is being formed to run and maintain RaiseTheFist.com, as well as keep the RaiseTheFist Direct Action Network going. Because, I mean, RaiseTheFist isn't just a website, it's also a direct action network made up of different chapters in different local areas all around the world. I mean, from Brazil to Australia to, different places in Canada, and even here in the U.S., I mean, and that's growing as well. Like, new chapters are joining the network, like, every week. And, I mean, one of the things I want to make sure is that not just the website stays up, but this Direct Action Network continues to grow and more people continue to get involved with it, because one of the most important things about the website and the network itself is that it promotes autonomous organizing, autonomous thinking, which is basically going out there on your own and taking initiative on your own to basically organize within your own community and challenge the system, you know, in any way you can without having to be reliable on some central organization that's going to basically tell you what needs to be done. I mean, that's one of the most important things Raise the Fist promotes, is autonomous organizing and, you know, autonomous resistance.
Well, Sherman, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us, and I'm guessing it's going to be 4 years before we're even allowed to talk again. I hope it's not.
But
I know that you don't know where you're being incarcerated yet, but hopefully we'll be finding that out really soon, so people can send letters of support. I know a lot of people will want you to know that you're in their thoughts.
Just gonna, like, immediately after we find out where I'm gonna be sent to, it's gonna be posted on raisethefist.com, and there's also a list server on there that people can subscribe to get immediate updates on what's going on. I mean, everything from, you know, where I'm gonna be held at to just any other kind of legal updates that are happening.